Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Back to it. I'm your host, Scott Horton. On to our next guest. It's our good friend, Sheldon Richman. He is the vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at FFF.org and the editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom Foundation. Just $25 a year in print, $15 to read it online. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Sheldon?
I'm doing fine, and thanks for inviting me back.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here, and I'm very happy to have a chance to hear what you have to say and to give other people a chance to hear what you have to say about America's developing relationship with Iran, what it all means, where you think we are, and on like that. Of course, we're between meetings right now. They still have scientific talks or, you know, wonky talks going on between the actual technical expert types. But the politicians are between meetings right now. But you've written some really good articles lately at FFF.org and at Reason Magazine, etc. Can Iran trust the U.S.? Does Obama have the courage to see this thing through? I forgot the rest of it. And stop demonizing Iran. And, of course, you know, all those titles could just be one long essay, I guess. I don't know, whichever you think is the most important idea to start with here, whatever it is you want to say. I want to hear what you think about where things are going, how optimistic or not, et cetera.
Yeah, well, the three articles, which were, you know, op-ed length size, could, you're right, could be easily knitted together into a longer essay. It's three different angles on the same subject, namely this opening with Iran. And because what I tried to do in the first one was to remind people of the history of Iranian-American relations by turning the question around. Most people, you know, are wondering, in the United States at least, wondering, you know, can the United States trust Iran? And I turned that around to, can Iran trust the United States? And I tried to go through very briefly the history of U.S.-Iranian relations since 1953, which most people don't know about. Of course, it begins in 53 when the U.S. Thwarts and helps overthrow a democratic prime minister who had been elected by an elected parliament and who, you know, was left of center, was no kind of, you know, raving Marxist or anything, but, you know, talked about nationalizing the British oil interests, and the U.S. went to bat for Britain and for itself ultimately, and sent the CIA in with, you know, bags of cash to foment resistance against Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister, and by driving him out of power, it restored the power of the Shah, the monarch, the Shah of Iran. He then proceeded to, you know, institute a regime of brutality with secret police, you know, for the next 26 years. His close ally, by the way, was Israel, who armed him and trained his Savak secret police, and it was not a very nice place to be. That, as a result, stimulated the religious forces in Iran, and this culminates in a revolution in 1979, which was really an alliance of religious types and liberals to overthrow the Shah, the dictatorial monarch. But in the end, the religious factions take control, and we get, you know, what everybody, well, a lot of people might remember now happened in 1979, including the hostage taking of the people in the U.S. Embassy for 444 days. And beginning on that date, of course, the U.S. then began a campaign of covert warfare or proxy war against Iran ever since, which continues up to the current day. So the question is, can Iran trust the United States?
Yeah.
The other pieces then talked about how...
Well, hold that thought for a second there, because I want to see if I can interject something here which seems interesting to me. Jimmy Carter famously, when the revolution happened in 79, they overthrew the American puppets and installed, Khomeini seized power there. Jimmy Carter referred to the coup of 53 as ancient history. And I certainly when it's 2013, almost the end of it now, and you and I are sitting here talking about 1953, I mean, even as you're speaking, I'm picturing Ike Eisenhower in black and white footage, and it does really feel like ancient history. But I just wanted to point out that for the 26 years that the Shah was in power, so what was 53 to the people in Iran of 79? That would be like if the Iranians had overthrown George H.W. Bush back in the late 1980s or very early 1990s and installed the Ayatollah here to rule over us in America. Would we be over it by now? Or we would just be biding our time until, even if we had to put Pat Robertson in charge, anyone who's actually from here, to get rid of the Iranian installed Ayatollah sock puppet here in our country. And then I also wanted to point out that here we are, longer than that, longer than 26 years later, and the Americans still hold just as much of a grudge over them overthrowing our sock puppet that we had installed there and won't forgive them for that an even longer time later when it's their freaking country, Sheldon.
Well, that's right. Ancient history was a polite way of saying irrelevant history. I wrote a paper actually based on that phrase by Carter. We should remember that a little more over a year before the Shah was finally driven from power, New Year's Eve, before 77, I believe, 77, 78, the Carters, Mr. and Mrs. Carter, President and Mrs. Carter, were celebrating New Year's Eve, ringing in the New Year with the Shah in Tehran and toasting him as this great man and great friend. And so, you know, the U.S. was very clearly identified with the Shah in the eyes of the Iranian people. And you're right. It wasn't ancient history to them in 1979. And it still is not ancient history. They know this. They're taught it. And who can blame them? The U.S. is the hegemon, the great hegemon. You know, they call it the great Satan, or did at least. Maybe that kind of language is being downplayed these days. But it's not without cause. And, you know, Americans are so innocent. You know, self-blinded about American foreign policy and anything that goes back a couple of years, right? They think history, because as you often point out, history begins the day that there's some outrage committed against the United States. It's always that day, and there's nothing that ever happened the day before, or the year before, or maybe several years before. So, I tried to point that out just to change the footing, change the whole way perspective that people are looking at this, you know, this latest, manifestation of the conflict with Iran, because it's not a question of can we trust them? Why should they trust, when I say us, well, I mean the U.S. government.
Well, now, in this specific case, do you think they can?
They have great reason to be skeptical. That's why I turned Obama's words around. And Netanyahu's words around, and the Israel lobby's words around. Actions have to be, words have to be matched by actions. Now I'm talking about Obama and the American government. Actions have to match the words. If the words are sounding pro-peace, and there's a little more of that coming from the White House these days, that's not enough. Real actions, and they should begin by taking off sanctions. I mean, they should just do the opposite of anything that Netanyahu says, do the opposite of. Sort of like George Costanza on the old Seinfeld show, right? Whatever he calls for, do the opposite, because that'll be closer to the wise policy. Mm-hmm. They need to begin. I mean, I think they shouldn't have the sanctions. They should remove them all. They shouldn't for anything Iran does. They should remove the sanctions. It's a monstrous policy directed at the Iranian people. I love how the media like to talk about how, oh, the sanctions are really biting the Iranian economy, crippling the Iranian economy. You can't bite or cripple an economy. You bite and cripple people. You make life hard for them. You make life hell for them. You deny them medicine. You deny them the food. That's not an economy. That's people. We need to talk about this in concrete, individualistic terms. We are inflicting great hardship on innocent people, and you can't justify it by saying, "Well, we don't like their regime." So that's the first thing I wanted to point out, that the trust issue really runs the other way.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to point out is the so-called charm offensive of Rouhani, the president, which was getting so much attention when he and Obama were appearing at the UN in New York, is nothing new. It's to call it a charm offensive, and it's shameful for the media to call it a charm offensive. It's one thing for an advocate to call it that. If you don't like Iran, yeah, you then stigmatize it as a charm offensive. But the media ought to strive for a little more detachment. If they knew a little bit of history, they'd realize this is not the first time the Iranians, Rouhani and people like him, have made these kinds of offers and overtures. There have been concrete proposals by the Iranians going back to 2001, and I'm sure we can go back earlier than that if we look hard, where they were trying to cooperate with the U.S. government. After 9/11, with regard to Afghanistan and Al Qaeda and Bin Laden and in other ways, they put forth a program to create transparency in their peaceful nuclear program. I say peaceful because the intelligence agencies of both the United States and Israel don't say they're not making a bomb. They don't have an intention to make a bomb. They gave up any movement toward turning that into a weapons program in 2003 when Saddam Hussein was overthrown. So much we could mention here. The U.S. was Saddam Hussein's ally in his war against Iran. They haven't forgotten that. Is that ancient history? So this is not new for Iran. They've tried to accommodate the United States. They want to be on the good side. They want trade. They want to be taken seriously. But, the U.S. has always refused. When the Swiss passed along a proposal from the Iranians in 2003, which was a comprehensive way to work everything out, including recognition of Israel and an embracing of the Arab League's 2002 package, which included all kinds of demands that Israel was calling for. Did Bush the second accept it? No, he reprimanded the Swiss for even passing along the proposal. And then, he put Iran in the axis of evil, which only built up the hardliners in Iran and discouraged the people like Rouhani, who back then was a negotiator and behind this peace package. So the U.S. record is horrendous on this. There's no way you can square it with the desire for peaceful coexistence with Iran. So the question now is, which is addressed in the third article, is whether Obama has the courage to pursue peace. He may really, I don't think he wants a war with Iran. That would be horrendous. He's got too many troubles as it is. I don't think he wants to be distracted by that. For whatever the reason, whether it's cynical political calculation or just good faith, I don't think he wants a war with Iran. But there are a lot of other people that do want a war with Iran, including Netanyahu, including many people in his government, and including the advocates for his government in the U.S. Congress and among the lobbyists. Which mainly means AIPAC and organizations like that. They want to sabotage any move toward peaceful coexistence with Iran, and they're in a position to do it because for sanctions to come off, Congress would have to approve that. Because as the leverets like to point out, and they've been guests on your program, so these sanctions are not just executive orders that could be rescinded by Obama any time. A lot of them have been turned into legislation, and that. And the conditions for removing them aren't just transparency in their nuclear program, but it includes other things, which basically means ceasing to be an Islamic republic. In other words, regime change. And obviously, the Iranians are not going to agree to that.
Yeah, probably not for now, anyway. All right.
So you got people who do not want peace, who are ready to sabotage Obama, even if he were to try to go full bore toward, an arrangement with Iran that would end this ridiculous relationship that we've had since '79 and earlier. So that's the question.
I got to tell you, Sheldon, I'm pretty good at this, if only because I've been doing it a long time. But I can't figure out this Obama guy sometimes because all politicians are going to promise one thing and do another and all of that. But he stakes out ground that is terribly politically unpopular among the powerful, but are the kinds of things that the American people might support, like his Cairo speech, little stuff like that. let's get rid of nuclear weapons one day. Well, never mind that one. But just how about his you know, his declarations of how far he's going to go on Palestine and on Iran or even Guantanamo Bay. And then it gets him in nothing but trouble in D.C. And then he just gives up. But come on, he's got to be able to think more than a couple of weeks ahead that, hey, once people start objecting to this, am I going to back down then? Or is that when I'm going to deploy argument B that's really effective or something? You know what I mean? What would you do?
Yeah.
Even if you were him, never mind if you were you in his position, but even if you were him, wouldn't you just not make a big deal about a nuclear deal with Iran and not make a big deal out of rolling back the settlements on the West Bank? Because why bother if you don't really mean it? Because in either case, he is still the emperor of the planet Earth. And if he wanted to tell Netanyahu, oh, no, you're not expanding the settlements, you're tearing them down, then Netanyahu would do it if he made him do it. If he said, I'm not asking, I'm telling, that would be the end of that for the settlements in the West Bank. And same thing for the nuclear thing. If he told the Congress, even the Republican leaders, that shut up, I'm making foreign policy and I'm making peace with this country right now and I'll not have you interfering with it. And Americans, they're trying to stop me from making peace. Get them. If he did that, he would win in a day and it would be easy. And yet, what's he going to do? He set himself up for failure again. He's going to blow himself up over this again. But why? I don't get it. Is it just because he's a Democrat and that's what Democrats are? Or what is his problem, man? Sorry for the giant rant, but it kind of bothers me because I really want this thing seen through, but I don't see it being seen through at all.
Well, I think you've sized him up pretty well. You're right. He's all over the map, and it's like he's trying to please many, many different constituencies, and you can't please them all. So, you know, one day he's working on one, and then the next day he's working on another. If you look at his record on Israel and the occupation of Palestine, it's pretty dismal. I mean, look what they did. Curry, claims this great achievement, restarting of the peace process. And who do they appoint? Martin Indyk to oversee it. Martin Indyk is an Israel partisan. He was at AIPAC, and then he was one of the heads of the think tank spun off by AIPAC. Mm-hmm. The Washington Institute on Near East Affairs, I guess, Near East Policy. Mm-hmm. And, why would you put him in charge of it, overseeing it? So I don't know. I mean, I can't get in the guy's head. I can't psychoanalyze him and tell you why he's doing this. I don't think he's merely the sophisticated thinker that people, generally believe he is. He doesn't seem to be. I mean, look, just like you said. I mean, did he go to Cairo in the beginning because he was basically campaigning for a Nobel Prize? I mean, that makes more sense. Because then who cares what he says, after he gets the prize or what he does after he gets the prize?
Well, maybe it's really just, he's kicking the can down the road, only it's more of a punt. He's kicking it really far down the road, but that's still all it is he just wants to leave, like Bush did. He wants to leave office with the status quo where it is and let it be somebody else's problem.
Perhaps, and then he can say on his record that we tried to restart the peace process. I put quotation marks around peace, because how do you have a peace process when Israel keeps gobbling up the land, which is the subject of the peace process, negotiations? That's ridiculous. They just announced they're going to build 5,000 more homes in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. I mean,
I was actually talking about Iran. I think he's just barely kicking the can down the road on Palestine. On Iran, it seems like a pretty big opening to just make nothing of it.
Well, you may be right. I mean, I don't know where it's going to go. Iran is apparently taking it seriously. And so, from what we hear, and I learned this from guests you've had on, what's her name, Barbara Slavin, is it, who mm-hmm. you had on recently?
Yeah.
Who pointed out, wrote an article about, based on a good source on what Iran is offering in detail, which is enough, that should make us optimistic about Iran's side of it. Question is Obama serious about it, or is he just going through the motions because he wants to be seen as a peace president without having to really take any steps in that direction, or he doesn't want to fight with Congress, he doesn't want to fight with McCain and Graham and the other people who are doing the bidding of AIPAC on the question of sanctions. But there could come a confrontation. I mean, what if Netanyahu outright tries to sabotage all this? It's been pointed out by good analysts on this that if the U.S. should come up to some agreement with Iran, that would hurt Netanyahu would be out of luck at that point, because how do you attack Iran when Obama's putting a signature to an agreement? You can't do it. So he's got to act before that. That's the clock that's ticking on him, right? The possibility that Obama will sign an agreement with Iran. Not that Iran will create a nuclear bomb. And then, and every day there's some report coming out of Israel about how now we see that they're only a month away from a nuclear bomb. I saw that headline just a couple of days ago. They're getting really worried now. Maybe they don't have anything to worry about. Maybe Obama really is not going to sign an agreement. No. I don't know how that's going to go.
Well, yeah, one of their most loyal frauds in the American media, Eli Lake, put out a piece just like that too, which John Glazer destroyed at the anti-war blog. This gigantic headline about how close Iran is to the bomb, and then the actual substance of the article is they've taken the slightest defensive measures against American aggression, trying to protect their scientists from being assassinated and trying to protect their codes from being broken. That's all indication of an aggressive threat.
Oh, right. Even in the past, when Ahmadinejad or somebody would say, if you attack us, we will attack you, that was regarded as aggressive and threatening. Yeah. If you attack us, we will retaliate was regarded as an aggressive threat. I mean, it was reported as if that was an aggressive threat. And I would say, wait a second. And they say, isn't there a conditional in there? If we attack them, it's like we have the right to attack anybody. And should they dare retaliate or defend themselves, that's aggression against us. I mean, that's how people look at it.
Well, and you talk about outright sabotage of the thing. I don't have any solid proof on this. I guess maybe I need to ask Phil Giraldi if he knows anybody who knows or something like that, but there have been some Jundala terrorists, some Bin Ladenite types there from Balochistan, the region that's bisected by Iran and Pakistan there, southeast Iran, southwest Pakistan, and 14 or 16 of them were hanged recently after an attack on some border guards just last week. So this very well could be either the CIA or Israeli intelligence, again, backing these Bin Ladenites against Iran. I guess it'd be more likely that these are Netanyahu's Bin Ladenites this time, rather than, like Dick Cheney's. Although I guess you don't want to count that guy out completely, but no. Looks like this could very well be the Israelis trying to sabotage the talks. This worked, remember, back in October of 2009, Sheldon, when they killed a general in the Revolutionary Guards, something like that, and that caused the domestic politics in Iran to completely turn against a deal. And it was a dispute at the time between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei. And apparently Ahmadinejad wanted to make the deal more than Khamenei did, at least at that point. I might have it the other way around. I think they switched positions. But anyway, but that Jundala attack of October 09 killed it. And then the bogus calm revelations were the icing on the cake there. But so that could be this right now,
Well, maybe. I mean, what people don't understand, what Americans generally don't understand, is that in this covert and proxy war against Iran, it's really no holds barred. I mean, anything is permissible, it seems like. You've got cyber warfare, you got assassination of scientists, you got these groups that come in and commit terrorism, you got the delisting, of the MEK as a terrorist group. Which is, merely a way to encourage them, which a lot of, course, ex-American officials have been doing by speaking at their meetings and getting big honorarium for speaking, like Ed Rendell, Pennsylvania, and who's the guy from Vermont?
Howard Dean.
Yeah, Howard Dean. Oh, that whole group.
Oh, a whole lot of them, yeah.
They've been encouraging, those groups and that group and terrible things have gone on. Here's one thing Obama could do just as a start, and it doesn't even involve sanctions, although I think the sanctions should be abolished. Why didn't he just announce that military force is now off the table? They love that phrase. I once quipped that the politicians ought to be barred from having tables. That way they'd have no place to put all their options. Why doesn't he just announce that? Military force is now off the table. I now announce that. Because they love to say all options, including military force, and that would include nuclear, are on the table. When you say all options, just do that rhetorically as a first step. I would still say action should be consistent with words, but utter those words. Just do that.
Right, it'd be a great start. And, you know, the restrictions on the shipping and the central bank that is at this point a de facto ban on any medicines that they can't make themselves, I mean, that's got to stop. I don't care what, you know, the Iranian position on anything is. If they start testing secret H-bombs tomorrow, you still got to let them import medicine.
Yeah, you know, there was a great analysis. I wish I could remember who it is now that who wrote this not that long ago, pointing out that, you know, Iran is a country that has a large middle class and a well-educated middle class. And these people are friendly to Americans. They don't dislike Americans. They don't dislike Jews. There's a very old Jewish community in Tehran and I think elsewhere in Iran that are not get any special negative treatment by the government. Ahmadinejad gave a subsidy to the hospital. There's a big Jewish hospital which doesn't only treat Jews or only employ Jews in Tehran. And Ahmadinejad gave him a subsidy. Now, you know, as a libertarian, I'm against government subsidies, but that's indicative of something. So they're not anti-Semites. They don't want to see Jews die. And you know that the business about wiping Israel off the map was debunked by lots of people. So, you know, this is a country that there's no reason why we couldn't be perfectly friendly with.
That's what I'm saying, too. Thanks, Sheldon. I sure appreciate your time on the show, as always.
Great talking to you. Thanks.
Everybody, that's the great Sheldon Richman. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Read his articles. Can Iran trust the U.S.? Stop demonizing Iran. And does Obama have the courage to pursue peace with Iran? FFF.org. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo quality, full color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use and your political cause or campaign too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. no water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.